If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, April the 23rd, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Institution Research Fellow and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today via Skype from an undisclosed location somewhere in the vicinity of the Stanford University campus is Colonel Joseph Felter. Colonel Felter is a Hoover Institution Research Fellow and the William J. Perry Fellow at the Stanford-based Center for International Security Cooperation. He returned to the Hoover Institution last year from the Pentagon, where he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia. Let me translate that to you in another way. It means he was the principal advisor to the nation's senior military leadership for all policy matters pertaining to development and implementation of defense strategies and plans for that region. A former U.S. Army Special Forces and Foreign Affairs officer, Colonel Felter served in a variety of special operations and diplomatic assignments. He also participated in multiple combat deployments, including Panama with the 75th Ranger Regiment, Iraq with the Joint Special Operations Task Force, and Afghanistan, where he commanded the COMISAF Counterinsurgency Advisory and Assistance Team. Joe, how are you, my friend?
Doing well, Bill. Thanks for the chance to join you. Sorry we're not face-to-face, but we'll make it work given the circumstances.
So, easy question for you. Did any of your special forces training prepare you for an extended quarantine like this with your family, I might add?
You know, we had a school called Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, where we ended up getting put in a small box for some period of time. So it hasn't gotten that extreme yet. I'll look at that as it could be worse.
Even with teenagers.
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk today about Afghanistan, where you have served. A sad note, yesterday, April the 22nd, was the 16th anniversary of Pat Tillman's death in Afghanistan, the former NFL player who became a Green Beret. Afghanistan, Joe, was very much in the news in February, and then COVID struck, and it seemed to have gone into a very back burner. On February the 29th, President Trump announced an agreement in which the U.S. and NATO allies will withdraw all troops from Afghanistan over the next 14 months, which means, Joe, that by this time, late April of next year, the U.S. should have its troops out of there. I did a little sleuthing in preparation for this. There are about 12,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Now some stats for you, Joe. Operation Enduring Freedom, which went from 2001 to 2014, that is the official name for the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, 2,350 military deaths. Operation Iraqi Freedom, 2003 to 2010, 4,400 military deaths. The United States involvement in Vietnam, a very long arc of history, which covers almost 20 years, 41,000 combat deaths. Joe, let's put Afghanistan into this context. You've written a piece for the Hoover Institution in which you talk about the Soviet experience of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. What parallels do you see between that and what the U.S. is looking at now?
Well, thanks for the chance to talk about that research, Bill. First of all, of course, the U.S. and Soviet experience, very significant differences between, you know, certainly the Russian, the then Soviet military, U.S. military, Najibullah, the Afghan president that the Soviets backed, and the political leadership that we are supporting. But there are some interesting parallels, and I think that the Soviet experience can inform some of the challenges and even potential opportunities that we have as we develop an exit strategy. But when the Soviets left, they made sure that they continued their aid and assistance, and they maintained one major strategic goal, and that was to try to ensure that the Najibullah, their person in Kabul, if you will, didn't fall. And really, despite some significant challenges, the Soviet-trained security forces with this limited security system assistance, they were able to defend Kabul and avoid the fall of major population centers. They had a lot of competing power factions, but they were kept at bay by the Soviets in a very carefully distributed, targeted aid and economic assistance program, where they gave it to local authorities, and they conditioned the aid on support for the government in Kabul. So this aid, with a range of other carefully orchestrated political, economic, military, and diplomatic initiatives, they all combined to help prop up the Soviet-installed government ensured its survival literally almost 3 years after the troops left. It really wasn't until the demise of the Soviet Union itself and the cessation of aid that we saw the whole house of cards tumble when Najib Bula left. But I would say the broad historical lesson from that's relevant to the United States policymakers today from the Soviet experience is to clearly identify the minimal strategic goal that we have. And then put in place sustainable incentives, even disincentives, to help ensure that this objective can be secured after the troops leave. And I wrote another piece, a recent War on the Rocks, where I argued this minimal strategic goal, I think, should be no forced regime change. The government may look different than it is now. There may be some power sharing arrangement if the current government and Taliban can come to some political settlement. But if we make a minimal strategic goal, no force regime change, meaning the Taliban can't take over by force, then I think that's a good thing to focus on and a good thing to put our targeted aid incentives in place to try to achieve.
Let's talk a bit more about that. So the U.S. withdrawal, Joe, is based upon one thing, the chances of the Afghan government and the Taliban reaching a peace accord. There's obviously one issue that has to be there, the peace accord for the United States. You cannot allow al-Qaeda to come back into Afghanistan. That's why we went into Afghanistan in the first place. But from a U.S. perspective, Joe, as we watch these two parties sit down and negotiate and try to strike a peace, what else has to be on the table from an American perspective?
Well, I think you hit it, Bill, as far as our vital interest in no return of al-Qaeda, no safe havens for terrorists that can do us harm in the homeland. I think you nailed it, but with that goal comes so many other, I think, intermediate objectives. I think one challenge we have now is, talk's cheap. The Taliban, they really can't credibly commit to anything that they say right now, cutting this deal. And I think one of the challenges with this peace accord is once we do leave, once our troop presence is gone, we lose a considerable amount of leverage. Both with our troops on the ground, their ability to collect intelligence, which is important for counterterrorism operations, ability to identify when the Taliban may be cheating or not following their rules. So when we lose boots on the ground, if you will, we lose a lot of leverage and a lot of ability to have eyes and ears in ways that technical collection is not going to help you get. And this leverage, we also, in some degree, we've held, like the Soviets, we've held things together in Afghanistan in some ways with the help of what I call, we purchased cooperation from some of the competing factions. If aid is conditioned on having to play by the rules and support the government, then they have incentives to cooperate and support the government. You take this aid away, we start to get some trivial forces, if you will. We've lost the ability to keep some of these factions from working well together. And again, I mentioned it's just really hard to enforce any deal once we're gone. Many suspect the Taliban is really, they'll commit to a lot of things now, but they're going to renege when the U.S. presence is gone and we have no ability to enforce those commitments.
So I mentioned in the introduction that you have been in Panama, you've been in Iraq, and you've been in Afghanistan. Those are obviously three corners of the world, Joe, that have very different topography, different terrains. But to the listener who may be curious as to what it is like to actually physically be in Afghanistan and be involved in this effort, what was it like to be there?
Well, this is one of the challenges about Afghanistan. It is so different. There's incredible diversity in Afghanistan, both in terrain, demographics, threat. I've been in Afghanistan several times in different periods, but one part of the country, it's a full-on gunfight. Another part of the country, it is peaceful. You can move about and do what you want. There's difference between the Pashtuns and in the south, in a different language, if you will, up north. So I would say it is a different fight. Where we're in so many different places. And I think that's a challenge of developing policies because they have to be tailored to the local threat conditions. And then those threat conditions, they're going to vary across space and over time. So, what will work for you 1 year, you may come back in a successive tour a few years later, very different conditions. So I guess the one thing I would say is Afghanistan is a diverse country with diverse people, diverse threat conditions, and in counterinsurgency, you really have to tailor your strategy, your operations, even your tactics to reflect the unique characteristics of the locality that you're working in. And that's a really, really challenging thing to do. It requires expertise and initiative down at the very lowest levels of our military, and that's a tall order to fill.
Right. So let's look at a year from now, Joe, maybe summer of next year. And if this does go according to plan, according to schedule, the final U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan, at which point you will get a ton of legacy stories. The media love to write legacy stories the moment that the U.S. leave a country, be it Afghanistan, Iraq, Grenada, you name the country. I don't want you to predict what the legacy story will be, but for your perspective, if you had to write the legacy story yourself, and you probably will write this at some point, what would you say? What is the legacy of our involvement there?
Yeah, great question. I don't think anyone is going to second guess the decision there, you know, post 9/11 with thousands of dead Americans. You know, we knew where the threat came from. We knew these terrorists had safe haven in Afghanistan, and we knew that they could reach out and threaten us and our allies and partners and others around the world again. So I think going in there in the late fall of 2001, and I had some friends on those early missions, and obviously there's been some books and movies about them, but just an extraordinary time. So we had clarity of mission, clarity of purpose then. But, you know, then things changed. You know, we had what was called mission creep. And it's in some ways it's understandable. I mean, this is a country that really needed our help. And we actually made a lot of difference in our presence there. You know, as far as the improvements in livelihood and mortality, the women's rights. So there was some good, but admittedly, you know, going on almost two decades, I think the legacy story is that maybe we wanted to do more than even the Afghans wanted us to do. And if I could try to expand on that, you know, we don't like to lose. That's a U.S. nature. My experience as a senior counterinsurgency team commander under General Chris or General Petraeus, I visit these brigade commanders, battalion commanders in the field. You know, they want to win. And, you know, there's a T.H. Lawrence quote, Lawrence of Arabia, that says it's better for Arabs to do things poorly than to do it yourself, as a loose paraphrasal. I think that's one of our challenges. We got there, you had a year on the ground, you want to make a difference, and we operated sometimes more unilaterally than we should have. I think in some ways we lost focus that our mission here as a third party counterinsurgency force, if you will, you know, we're advising, we're working by with and through the Afghan military and police force. The real goal is to build the capabilities of the Afghan government and the Afghan military, the Afghan police. And I think, you know, that was a challenge. And also there's the limitations of what the military can do. I'm a military person, but this, you know, counterinsurgency is inherently a political challenge. And importantly, if you're a third party counterinsurgent like the United States was, you know, counterinsurgency can only be as good as the government that it's supporting. In this case, you know, the Afghan government was really lacked a lot of legitimacy in the eyes of many Afghans across the country. If I have time, a quick story. I remember in my last deployment in Kandahar, I was talking to a local elder through an interpreter, and he said that, hey, you know, we really need the Taliban here to protect us from the police. And I thought that was, I didn't speak Pashtun. I spoke a little Dari, but I thought that was a mistake in the translation. I asked the interpreter to tell it to me again. That's absolutely what he said, that in fact, these Dari-speaking, literally foreign Afghan police forces to these Pashtuns were holding them up, were shaking them down, were doing bad things to their women, and the Taliban came in and protected them. So in the eyes of this village, the Afghan government was part of the problem, not the solution, and the United States were supporting the government, which inherently made them part of the problem as well. So a takeaway here is, I think, back to your original question, what's the legacy is? We can't want things more than the Afghan people. They want it themselves, and that we can't be better than the government, and we can only be as legitimate as the government is in the eyes of the people. So this is really about governance, and I think in the military you can get focused on, you know, military operational tactical gains, and I think we kept fighting those and making some progress, but in the end, because the Afghan government didn't quite have the legitimacy or the support of the people, we were never going to get to the level we had hoped for to begin with. But I just want to say that it's not for lack of really amazing people, you know, given they're all literally sacrificing their lives in some cases. I mean, United States' commitment to this was extraordinary and admirable. But at the political level, strategic level, I'm afraid that maybe they're just set up for never achieving the more lofty goals that we may have hoped for in the early years.
I understand the reason for going in. It was to root out al-Qaeda, ultimately capture or kill bin Laden, and prevent another 9/11. But was there an exit strategy when we first went in, Joe? In other words, we knew the goal, but then did we have a strategy in place for how to leave?
No, I don't think we did. And again, it's not for lack of a lot of quality leaders looking at it hard. And I'll admit, it's maybe there's some cognitive dissonance here because I was there. I have friends that didn't come back. And you just want to believe that some goodness came out of these efforts. But as far as our exit strategy, I'm afraid maybe similar to Iraq, and then really so many of these small wars and insurgencies, if you will, the exit strategy becomes a bit muddled because clearly, to our military and coalition forces credit, we took down the Taliban pretty quickly. But then we thought, well, maybe we can build Afghanistan, help Afghanistan build up its capabilities in ways that, it can sustain. It can be, go down the path of democracy and then these improvements in quality of life and rights of women and all the things that we'd hoped for Afghanistan could come to pass. So it's right. It's a little. Anyway, so the short answer is no. I don't think we had a clear exit strategy, and some could argue that we're still working on that even at this late date.
Right. So I look at Afghanistan, I look at Iraq, and you see what in common. You're going in and trying to prevent terrorism from happening. There is a difference, though. Afghanistan, you're working with the government. In Iraq, you're deposing a government. But I do see a common thread here, Joe, which is a concern, and that is it's not the U.S. military involvement. I think we can go into most any corner of the world and win a military engagement. We have sufficient firepower. If we have the patience and willingness to fight at a certain level, we'll prevail. It's the question, though, Joe, of winning hearts and minds, and that seems to be the challenge here. We struggle with this in Afghanistan. We struggle with this in Iraq, and as you look at these two episodes, these two chapters, and looking ahead to maybe any U.S. involvement elsewhere in the world, how do we do a better job of winning hearts and minds?
Well, and Billy, it's a great question, and I think I mentioned it earlier that the limitations on what the United States or any foreigner can do as far as winning hearts and minds, and in some recent book I published, co-authored last year, we coined the term not winning hearts and minds, but the goal I think for the military, or the limitation of the military would be more accurately termed leasing hearts and minds, where the military can go in and create the conditions, provide the security, where ideally the host nation government can actually go in and win the hearts and minds by providing the goods and services and the good governance that people need to say, hey, I'm going to trust and bet on my own government versus the Taliban. And sometimes it's not a choice of which option is better. It's an option like, well, the Taliban, I know there's going to be retribution. There's going to be night letters if I support the government. Maybe they don't think that their own government can defend them, even though in a perfect world they'd like to see a democratic Afghanistan.
All right. So if we do pull out of Afghanistan, this is the second time now in the Trump administration in which we have dialed down our presence. The other example being Syria, obviously. Is this the beginning of a pattern, Joe? And is there a danger here that we are drifting back to the Obama years and the idea of leading from behind?
I wouldn't characterize it that way. As a special forces, former special forces officer, you leading by with and through partners, for example, some people, it's not leading from behind. In fact, I may pivot a little bit on that question because, there's Sun Tzu has a quote to defend everywhere is to defend nowhere. You can't punch in both directions at the same time.
Right.
And we've got to make some tough choices on where we're going to allocate our resources. If you're familiar with the current national security strategy, national defense strategy that was developed with this administration, we've kind of recognized that we are now in a period of long-term competition. Russia and China really deserve, we're going to need to compete effectively with them. And as we pick our fights based on threats to our national interests, some fights like Afghanistan, small wars and insurgency, I'll say there's nothing small about a war when you're in the middle of it. But we are going to have to make some tough choices based on how we're going to allocate our resources. Going forward, and the challenge is you can't always, the enemy has a vote. We can't just walk away from preparing for these types of conflicts. If this isn't going off topic, I remember as a cadet at West Point, I had a a major Dave Petraeus. You may recognize that name, who was one of my instructors. And he was busy writing a dissertation at Princeton at the time on his, you know, at night in the on his off-duty time on lessons learned from Vietnam. And we were thinking, this is the height of the Cold War. Like, God, that's like so 1975. You know, what are you worrying about that for? But tying into your question, there's a lot of different threats out there. We don't have the luxury of choosing which one to prepare for. I would say we're at a period now where we are very cognizant of the threats posed by near-peer competitors like Russia and China. I wouldn't call them near-peer, but greater powers, relative powers like Russia and China. And that may require us to accept some risk in intervening in the types of conflicts that we have been very decisively engaged with over the last 20 years. But that said, we can't lose vigilance. We still need to prepare our militaries to execute those types of missions, and they're difficult. They take investments, and especially in the human capital of our soldiers and our leaders. But again, I don't think we're leaving behind. I think we're making a calculated decision that we're going to prioritize our resources for different threats. But you know, I guess hindsight will tell us if we're making the right calls.
You know, Joe, you know, I thought this was going to be a COVID-free conversation, but I think I do have a COVID-related question in this regard. As this crisis plays out in the United States and abroad, there's possibly a danger here at home in that we will become a much more contracted, insular nation, wary of foreign entanglements, just not willing to. This is one of the lessons from the influenza strain of 1918, and coincided with the U.S. involvement in World War I, and the nation just becoming very insular and not wanting to engage in other nations' affairs. Do you see any threat like that coming out of what's going on right now? In other words, do you think it would be a harder sell for a president a year from now to say that we have to react to the crisis and X, Y, and Z by putting U.S. troops in there?
Well, you know, that is an incredibly difficult decision for any president, you know, and any leader. So it should always be a decision that's made very carefully. And you make a decision that risks losing, you know, our blood and treasure, our you know, America's finest young men and women. That's always a tough decision. It should never be made lightly. Tying it back to COVID, I'm just not sure. I would say America has historically, you know, stood up for defending, you know, freedoms and democracy, you know, abroad. But we owe it to our own citizens to be very, very careful where we commit our resources. But I do say with coming economic impact, you know, we're going to see a lot of cuts in budgets. I think we're going to be probably like everyone a bit more constrained than what we are able to do, and making those decisions even more important. We're very careful about this allocation of resources. So, yes, we certainly don't know the full cost of the COVID crisis, but I imagine in a more resource-constrained world, we're going to be even more careful about how we expend our resources abroad and where we risk our blood and treasure, and making sure that those are really based on, you know, threats to vital interests to our citizens.
You mentioned your encounter with Major Petraeus while you were at the point. What year did you graduate from West Point?
Oh, you're going to bust me out here. Let's just say the Cold War was still going on, but not for much longer. You know, I graduated in 1987. I think Major Petraeus was actually going to speak in my class at my Stanford Hacking for Defense class here next week, virtually. But I believe he was probably a mid-70s class. So, but just a real privilege to work for him several more times later in my career.
Okay, so you're at West Point from the mid to 1980s. Tell me, what wars did you study while you're attending there?
You know, it's great. We, you know, had a fantastic military history program. But, you know, this was, we didn't know we were near the end of the Cold War. We thought we were probably in the middle of it. So we were very much, I think we studied all conflict, but it's very much with a conventional focus. I think we looked at Vietnam as maybe as, you know, an exception, an aberration, although it really shouldn't have been. I mean, we had the, you know, the Philippine War at the turn of the century, what they call was America's first Vietnam. And we, you know, our Marine Corps fought small wars and insurgencies in Latin America. But I think the Corps at the time in the 80s, we were focused on, you know, defeating the Soviets in the fold of gap. It was height of the Cold War, and it was clear, you know, there was good guys and bad guys, good and evil. You know, Ronald Reagan was our president. We felt like, hey, we know who the enemy is and where they are. And then, boy, that just got turned on its head as we, in these last couple of decades of war. You know, as you recall, you know, contrast December 7th, 1941 with September 11th, 2001, as far as, in 1940, we knew where the attack came from. It had a return address, so we knew what we had to do. As a military person, you know, the cadets at the time said, we got to mobilize our resources and take it to the enemy. And then, you know, eventually you drove them into unconditional surrender. You signed peace treaties. You had parades. You kissed the nurse. You came back home. But boy, it just wasn't like that in this last couple of decades. You know, 9/11, we didn't even know who the enemy was, where it came from, and really hard to know what to do. And if you had asked me as a West Point cadet that my colleagues in Special Forces would be going to war on horseback in the 21st century, I would have just gone, you're right. But certainly that's what happened. So, but back to your question, I think at West Point, we studied all wars, but I thought we were preparing to continue to prevail and defeat and deter the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And boy, you never get to pick the fight you're in. And that's what you're going forward as well.
When you were attending the point, did you ever take a class in terrorism or counterinsurgency? Was that even offered?
It's a great question. The short answer is no. And again, I remember Major Petraeus working so hard on his PhD thesis, which was Vietnam lesson, but we didn't. But I will say I ended up back up there on faculty, and I was the director of a West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. And our director was just a legendary special operator named General Wayne Downing, who unfortunately passed suddenly while he was in the job. But he actually pushed to have an emphasis beyond counterterrorism, which everyone got. It was post 9/11 years, but also irregular warfare and insurgency, because that is a complex challenge. It requires, you know, deep study and understanding. It's well beyond military tactics. And I think I mentioned earlier that it's a small unit fight. And we ask our, you know, when I was in Afghanistan, I would visit remote areas where the commander on the ground was a, you know, 26-year-old special forces captain, and they would have to work with, you know, U.S. forces, Afghan forces, aid agencies. They'd have to, you know, fight the Taliban at night. They'd have to win the hearts and minds, or at least the hearts and minds during the day doing development projects. So it's a complex fight, and you need to start early. And, you know, shame on us when I was at West Point for not incorporating that in our curriculum, but we do it now. West Point, you know, my son is a plebe there. He's minoring in terrorism studies, and there are a wealth of courses that help prepare our young leaders early to prepare for what is a really complex, difficult challenge, which is counterinsurgency.
Right. Do you feel our officers are prepared when they come out of the point to deal with this? And I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I think the listeners should know this. You're not just a colonel, but you also are a doctor. You went to graduate school. You have a PhD. You came to the Hoover Institution and was involved in our National Securities Fellows Program. That's why I said you returned to Hoover in the introduction. So you have built upon your knowledge base of what you learned at West Point. Does the military need to think about officer training in this regard, not just what they learn in 4 years of the academy, but returning them to the classroom to learn more about civilizations, to learn more about history, and to learn more about this very complex issue that is terrorism and counterinsurgency?
Well, Bill, I think obviously with my background and experience, the answer is yes. You know, education is so critical, and I think that's what really differentiates, you know, our military from so many others. And especially, you mentioned officers coming out of West Point. I wouldn't want to sound elitist. It would be leaders at all levels. And you know, there's a saying in the U.S. military that our secret weapon is our non-commissioned officer. And I think it's spot on that the investments we make in our young leaders, our corporals and sergeants, it's extraordinary. And I've worked, you know, trained and deployed with militaries from all around the world. And the amount of investment we put into our non-commissioned officers is just head and shoulders above any other nation. And in a fight like counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, where I mentioned earlier, it's a local fight. You need to have that kind of expertise, initiative, and capabilities down to the lower level. This isn't like, you know, old school big formation fighting where you could just follow the guidon in front of you and, you know, move to the sound of guns and attack. It is a very complex fight. So to your question, absolutely, the more education, the better. You know, Hoover's own former Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, he's famous for, you know, has a 7,000 book library and actually read all of them. And he'll say you're functionally illiterate if you haven't read, you know, at least 1,000 plus books, if I got my number right. And I think he's right on. You know, there's nothing new under the sun, as people say, but if you don't read and learn and benefit from others' experiences, you suffer and you're the people that entrust you are going to, you know, become casualties because of your lack of education and preparation and training.
Right. So if I had to put you in the classroom at West Point, not to sit in the classroom, but to lecture in the classroom, to lead the conversation, what course would you want to offer? If you had to talk about your experience, not just in Afghanistan, but Iraq, Joe, what would you like to impart to our future officers?
To start in their course at West Point? Wow. So many. I'll pick one, and there's many. I think ethics is one. I think our young leaders, young men and women, are put in situations where they are have to make extraordinary choices. You know, their platoon may be taking fire from a building that, you know, has civilians in it, and they've got you know a JDAM, a smart bomb at the end of their radio hand, so they can just eliminate the threat. And all that, they don't have to write any letters home to grieving parents and loved ones from their platoon. But they may kill civilians, and it's such a gut-wrenching decision to make. But I would say courses on ethics, which we do have at West Point and all our service academies and all our commissioning sources, and again, even in our programs to train our fine non-commissioned officers. I would say that's what I'm most proud of about being an American former military is the deep appreciation for we're going to fight by the rules, if you will, that ethics, you can't ignore them. And you're going to have to do things that are very difficult, but you're going to have that moral compass guided by a deep grounding in ethical behavior in warfare, which is really difficult and requires exposure, education, motivation, inspiration early and often at all levels of our command, especially as you're preparing to take leadership positions as our young men and women coming out of the service academies and ROTC programs and officer candidate school are.
Let's talk a bit about South and Southeast Asia in a more general way, Joe. Asia, the extent the United States looks at Asia right now, the extent that Asia is in the news, two things. One is obviously the pandemic in China and the future of our relations with that. The second now an emerging story is the health of Kim Jong-un, and he may or may not be gravely ill. He may or may not die very soon, in which case, who knows what the future of North Korea is. It'll be a leadership vacuum. Maybe his sister steps in. Maybe the military does. Who knows? That's going to force us to rewrite American foreign policy there, I suppose. But what about South and Southeast Asia, Joe? What are the two or three defining narratives right now?
Wow. So, you know, let me go back to our national security strategy, national defense strategy. Three lines of effort. And the line of effort, I'll just skip to the one that I really focused on based on then Secretary of Defense Mattis's intent and certainly embraced by his successors. And that's line of effort two, which is, you know, we're going to, you know, strengthen alliances and build new partnerships. And I think Southeast Asia is a great, I guess, proving ground, if you will, to do that. It's a very diverse region, lots of different countries. Let me just cut to the chase. You know, when our national security strategy says we're in long-term competition, China is really the competitor that we're most concerned about. We certainly don't seek conflict with China. We seek cooperation wherever we can, but we need to be prepared to compete and compete effectively where we have to. And we're going to do that through our allies and partners. And in Southeast Asia, you've got the spectrum of countries as far as support for, I guess I don't want to say support for the U.S. or China, because we never ask countries to choose. But as far as, you know, you have countries on one end of the spectrum, like Cambodia, Laos, or literally in China's back pocket. You know, on the other spectrum, you have, you know, fiercely independent countries like Vietnam, who are you know, willing to stand up for their rights in the South China Sea and push back on China. And a lot of countries are like Singapore and countries in the middle. But I guess what I'd leave you with in Southeast Asia, this is an opportunity for America to lead. This is an opportunity where the good news is we have a shared vision for the future with all of these countries. When I visited in my former capacity, there was a thirst for U.S. leadership, a palpable thirst for it. We certainly were the security partner of choice. All my meetings, especially if they were closed door, where these officials didn't think their, you know, notes were being taken, or somehow it may get back to because let's face it, every country needs to have a positive, constructive relationship with China, certainly on the economic side. But I was encouraged by this thirst for U.S. leadership. But it has to be there. It has to. If we're the part of choice, we have to make sure these countries in Southeast Asia know it's a choice. And again, we're not asking them to choose U.S. or China. We're saying, choose your country, you know, Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand, going down the list. And we want to be a partner to help you defend that sovereignty. But Southeast Asia, it's a critical region. I would say it's in the balance. The good news is they want to partner with the United States. The reality is China's a full court press. They're coercing them. They're driving countries into serious debt. And let's admit, I know this is a politically sensitive topic, but while the U.S. is a partner of choice, we need to continue to invest and make sure that we're present, and countries know that we are in fact a choice, that we will be that partner, and that we actually execute our strategy, which I think is fantastic, and that's emphasizes the importance of working, strengthening these alliances and building partnerships.
I just heard the word invest. You know, Joe, I do a broadcast each week. It's called Goodfellows, and I'm very lucky. I get to moderate a conversation with Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran, all your colleagues here at Hoover. And the topic of the one we did yesterday was the Cold War with China. It was a great conversation. John Cochran doesn't really buy into the Cold War analogy, but Neil Ferguson and H.R. do. By the way, listeners, H.R. has written a really brilliant article on China that's in The Atlantic. Please track it down. But it seems to me, Joe, that if we're looking at if you want to use this Cold War analogy with China, I'm not sure if you agree with it or not, but if you do want to use that phrase Cold War, it's not the same in the Soviets in terms of an arms race, building missiles, standing them down militarily necessarily. There seems to be an economic component that was not there at the Soviets for a long time. We're going to have to compete with them economically across the globe. This is complicated because they could do something like the Belt and Road Initiative and spend trillions of dollars. I believe U.S. foreign aid last year was something like $40 billion. We're not going to spend trillions overseas. That's just not what we do. But you mentioned the word invest in talking about the U.S. presence in this region. Investment looks like what, Joe? Is it putting in hotels and restaurants? Is it the president leading trade delegations? Is it us loaning other countries monies? In other words, it gets back to this question of hearts and minds and how we instill confidence in these countries in the United States.
Thanks, Butch. It's a great question, and this is kind of the essence of the challenge that the team I was with in the Pentagon in the region during my recent service there. But I think you can invest in multiple ways. And certainly you mentioned economic. You mentioned the Cold War with the Soviet Union. Very different. The countries across the Indo-Pacific region around the world, they're just too economically dependent and intertwined with China. It's a very different conditions. You know, we didn't have a lot of economic, we didn't have a lot of trade and dependence on the Soviet Union, for example, nor did a lot of our allies and partners. So we have to accept that every country is going to need to have a constructive relationship, certainly on the economic and trade level with China. But we need to make sure they have alternatives. You know, you mentioned the Belt and Road Initiative. Clear risks to that, clear strings attached. You know, we can, multiple examples across the region, you know, like Sri Lanka and Laos and Cambodia and others, where they're driven into debt burdens, and they do these debt for equity swaps where China is actually undermining their sovereignty through their economic programs. But they need an option. China is there with a lot of easy money, and it's not just the United States, but they need to have alternatives. And certainly countries across the region are waking up to this. You know, Japan, the United States, we have our own programs, but I think we can make the case that, you know, investment from the United States, it's fair, it's transparent, it's not intended to undermine sovereignty. So I think we have better quality investment, but it is really hard to compete with just the sheer amount of investment. And you mentioned COVID. This could all change here when the economic conditions in China potentially change. But let me just, I'll try to finish with some good news based on my experience. I'll put a poker analogy. We have better cards. You know, when across the region, they look at, you know, in a Cold War with it's not a Cold War, but we have a vision that countries share across the region, and we just got to play those cards better. China, the truth hurts for China. They just need to be exposed for some of their activities. I remember I keep quoting Secretary Mattis, but he's just so quotable. When I was working under him, he would often say that to allies and partners, you can't expect China to treat you better than they treat their own people. And you look at, you know, the surveillance state, what they're doing to the Uyghurs in the West and so many of theirs, and that rings home. So going forward, and I know I'm running on here, but we just need to keep that door open for cooperation with China. We encourage all countries to have a constructive relationship, but we got to keep that door closed, if you will, to activities that undermine other countries' sovereignty. And I think that's countries across the region, certainly the region I worked in, they recognize that the U.S. is, they are that partner. They do share that vision. The more we can do to give them options, economically is harder. Security, I think it's more clear, but we just have to be there. We have to be a dependable partner. And I think that they're going to choose their own country, if you will, choose their own sovereignty. And I think if they do that, their relationship with the United States is going to look much, much more preferable and in their interest than a potential alternatives.
Final question, Joe, as you're part of the Stanford community, what if you were invited by Stanford to the extent there's going to be a homecoming this fall? I don't know if there's going to even be an academic session at Stanford this fall. It's a very open question. I imagine you've been curious about that, too. But let's say there is a homecoming weekend and you're invited as part of that, Joe, to give a TED talk, an 18-minute talk on Afghanistan. I don't want you to answer for 18 minutes. I want you to think about this. But if you had to summarize the American experience and the American legacy and the lesson of this experience in 18 minutes, what would be kind of the key takeaway for the audience?
Bill, easy question, right? So, again, with my background, I would say let's never forget the sacrifices of so many. Despite your views politically, let's always honor the sacrifices of so many, certainly Americans in our 20-year commitment there. But the lessons are, I would say, good intentions, great mission, but you do have to look, and this sounds a little simplistic, but whenever you go into a fight, you have to think about how you're going to get out, what kind of conditions, and set those conditions. And this mission creep that we experienced was, we can understand how it happened, we just can't do more of the same. So I guess a TED talk, I'd have to be a lot crisper. But I would say let's be very careful about where and when and how we intervene, when we put America's finest young men and women and blood and treasure at risk. Some threats are worth it, and our political leadership will make those decisions, and the military is there to execute. But then again, we remember that our political leaders, they make the decisions that the military executes, and let's make sure we appreciate those distinctions. But one thing I would say that, and this is from my, my father's a Vietnam veteran, and I'm getting off topic here. So this is after the TED talk. I would say, I'm encouraged how our public now has been able to separate their respect for servicemen and women from the politics of the wars they fought, which I don't think that was experienced by certain Vietnam veterans. And let's keep doing that. Let's remember that when you raise your hand and commit to serving in whatever service, that's a true mark of commitment and self-sacrifice. You don't know where you're going to be sent. You don't get to decide, but you basically write a blank check with your life to say, I'm going to go where my country sends me, and I'm going to put it on the line for others. So maybe I would put that in my TED talk, Bill. I would say respect the servicemen and women. Hold your political leaders accountable, vote, be active. Let's make sure we get the best policies that defend our national interests, but don't squander the precious resources, which is our American servicemen and women.
Let's leave it there. Colonel Joseph Felter, I enjoyed the conversation, and hey, hope to see you soon somewhere around the campus.
I hope so too, Bill. Stay healthy, and thanks for the chance to join you today.
Thank you, and I hope all remains well in the House of Felter.
Yes, thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to America's 45th president. In this case, the challenges facing America as it prepares to withdraw from Afghanistan. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes and tell your friends about us. By the way, this is not the only Hoover podcast. There's Econ Talk, The Classicist with the great Victor Davis Hanson. We do all kinds of chats for you, just waiting for you. We're also doing virtual policy briefings at Hoover Institutions. These are online. You can sign up for them. They're on Tuesdays and Thursdays. As I'm speaking to you right now, H.R. McMaster is doing one. Don't miss those. And I also mentioned the Goodfellows broadcast that I do each Wednesday with Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran. Lots of good content for you to help ride out the COVID storm. And by the way, where do you find all this? Simple. Go to the Hoover website, www.hoover.org. And while you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows. That most certainly includes Colonel Joseph Felter, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Colonel Felter, again, thank you for your service, and I hope you and your family stay safe.
Thank you, Bill.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. And as always, thanks for listening. See you soon.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.